Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Think Big Bodybuilding Media. I'm Scott McNally, and today we're going to talk with Dr. Mario Novo. He is an expert in all things blood flow restriction training. So today we're going to learn the foundations, you know, basically what BFR is and how it works, what the applications are, both in rehabilitation as well as in muscle growth. And guys, I got to tell you, he's a smart dude. This is going to go fairly deep. But if you stick with us, and you come out the other side, you will have learned some good foundational stuff, and you'll probably understand BFR a little bit better than you had going in. I know that I have. Guys, if you enjoy this show, if you get something out of it, do me a favor, hit the like button, and if you haven't subscribed yet, consider it, because we have several programs coming out each week. You can stay up to date with everything we have coming out. All right, guys, let's get to Mario.
I can really say you're kind of like the blood flow restriction guy. Is that an overstatement? I don't think so.
There's one of my mentors. I probably would say he's like the top pinnacle BFR guy, because I learned from him. Okay. He had an amazing. His name is Johnny Owens. He brought blood flow restriction kind of really to what it is in the United States through the military, and this came about after. We started to just fill up hospital rooms with a lot of soldiers that would have otherwise died on the battlefield, but were now surviving due to just advances in basically, battlefield medicine.
Okay.
So now we've got a bunch of soldiers come back, they're potentially going to lose a limb. So they get enrolled in what's called limb salvage. And that was a department that was really kind of we might be able to keep your leg. We might be able to keep your arm. We're going to do our best to help you. But it was a department that really needed an injection of kind of sports medicine, and as well kind of the start of what we call biologics. And that's pretty much where BFR started. In a nutshell, it was used to stop scar tissue formation, accelerate muscle protein synthesis. We'll get into that, because the two of them are actually inversely proportional to one another. That means that when your body is not wanting to build protein, it's wanting to build scar tissue, and vice versa. And our body does these particular things when we have an injury to conserve energy, because it's easier for your body to make like inert protein.
Yeah.
That's basically protein that makes up scar tissue that doesn't require you to, dynamically keep it around. Muscle, you have to stimulate it and you have to feed it to keep it around. Scar tissue, you don't. So it's your body's kind of first line of defense. Problem though, if you're trying to keep somebody's limb and you've had to transplant a muscle from one area of a body to another area of a body, and you're using maybe some sort of new technique where you take pig intestine and it kind of, you wash out all the pig cells and it's just kind of the main collagen, what we call scaffolding matrix.
Okay.
Plop that on, put some muscle on it, put some growth factors on it, and then it starts to grow. The problem, though, is that human being, although they're going to accept it because now it's clean, it's just tissue, it doesn't have any DNA of the pig in it per se.
Wait a second. You're blowing my mind, first of all. I didn't even know that was a thing, but...
Oh, yeah, that's a thing. Yeah. Our military had a lot of green lights to just experiment with stuff. So, like, one of the first drugs that they were trying was this drug called Sartan. And it was a drug that basically would inhibit this whole entire family called the TGF-beta family. And this family basically, when it's activated, makes scar tissue.
Yeah.
But it also shuts off muscle protein synthesis. So you've probably heard of like myostatin, and you've probably heard of mTOR, right?
Sure.
All right. So myostatin is your scar tissue pathway. And mTOR complex 1 or mTOR C1, that's your muscle protein synthesis pathway. Think of these things like on-off switches. So one's on, the other one's off, and they switch, right?
Okay.
So so think like you're a healthy person. You go to the gym, you work out.
Yeah.
There's a reason why you don't scar up every time you break down muscle, because you're activating mTOR complex 1, which deactivates myostatin, the scar tissue pathway.
Okay.
Now the difference is I get hurt, and the injury is sufficient enough to create inflammation, sufficient enough to activate my immune system, get my brain sensing the threat. Now I've got pain. I got a downregulation of muscle contractility. I'm not working out. Basically, I'm hurt.
Yeah.
So myostatin kicks in, mTOR kicks off. That allows me to build scar tissue and not make more dynamic protein, which is more energy let's say needing. It requires input of energy, right? It requires amino acids, it requires glucose. It's way too complex for your body to deal with that shit during the injury. So it says, I'm just going to make human super glue. Just put a bunch of scar tissue, throw it in there. So they made these drugs that did that. And the problem with the drugs is there was a lot of side effects. So they were like, you know, what else shuts off myostatin?
Yeah.
You go look in the research. Oh, man, exercise. Oh, man, we got to start having these patients start exercising.
Okay.
Well, there's a problem with that. That guy's missing a good chunk of his leg.
Yeah.
Or he just had major surgery. The bone has been demineralized or the bone was shattered. We've got, you know, wire and metal sticking out of these legs or arms to keep them around. And these soldiers are, you know, these guys are massively depressed. They're on a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
A lot of them are, you know, on, you know, wanting to commit suicide. There was a story where a guy took his leg and put it in a bucket of dry ice to try to damage his leg enough so that they would finally amputate it and give him a prosthetic.
Holy shit.
Because he couldn't live with the pain anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had a massive problem. They knew they needed to inject exercise. They didn't know how. And then they found out that there was a physician in Japan that was experimenting with something called blood flow restriction.
Huh. And, how long ago? When was this about?
We're going back to probably like late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
It gets started off by a physician. At the time, it's just a bodybuilder. So he puts basically an inner tube around his arm.
Huh.
And because he likes the sensation, it feels good. But then he starts to realize, damn, my arms are getting jacked.
Yeah.
So he continues to explore. But it doesn't really pick up until sometime around the mid-2000s when now there's more of a push to try to understand why that's happening. You know, why is this influencing hypertrophy?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the growth of muscle, which means that if we understand net protein balance, so net protein balance is the sum of muscle protein synthesis minus muscle protein breakdown.
Mm.
So it's a pretty simple math equation. If they're both equal to one another, the net protein balance is neutral.
Sure.
We would say that that's a maintenance amount of skeletal, you know, protein,
yeah,
skeletal muscle protein synthesis. If one is more negative, then obviously we would say, oh man, that's going to be a negative amount of net protein balance. So that could be atrophy.
Yeah.
And a positive would be then hypertrophy. So that used to be the thought. That's what we understood it to be. But as we kept kind of going and understanding these complex cases of these soldiers, which were just shedding muscle so quick because of the trauma was actually influencing an accelerated rate of sarcopenia, which sarcopenia, if for the audience who doesn't know, probably have heard osteopenia or osteoporosis.
Yes, osteoporosis, the same.
Yeah. So osteo, the prefix, it means bone. Porosis means porous. Penia means age-related loss.
Okay.
So, you know, you have stages of it. So sarcopenia, sarco is how we measure muscle via sarcomere. So sarcopenia means age-related loss of muscle. All of us eventually get sarcopenia as we get older.
Yeah.
But these soldiers are young.
Yeah.
Why are they showing signs of this accelerated muscle breakdown?
Yeah.
It's because the muscle was traumatized. So that myostatin trigger for scar tissue was way on. And that mTOR complex was off. So they were not producing any protein synthesis.
Okay.
So that net protein balance every day was going lower and lower and lower and lower. So these guys are shedding muscle. The muscle's becoming basically like a pre-diabetic muscle. Its insulin sensitivity is dropping. It's producing a bunch of pro-inflammatory stuff that's, you know, the mitochondria, little cells that make ATP. They're all shitty. They're not working well.
Mm.
So in the end, what ended up happening was they said, we need exercise. There could be something with this, with these tourniquets, this guy's wrapping around his arm.
This guy, and he's in Japan. He's a bodybuilder, you said?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, his last name is Sato.
Okay.
So Dr. Sato, he was a bodybuilder.
Huh.
And, I can give you more of his info later on. I'll pass you some stuff, but interesting guy. Didn't really dig much deeper into it.
Yeah.
But he's the one who basically, you know, like everything, man, it starts with an anecdote. It starts with observation, case study, case series. And then from there, you know, if there's interest, that's the unfortunate thing about research. Most people don't understand is there has to be some sort of financial interest for people to get involved and want to sponsor it.
Yeah.
but there wasn't any, which is why I didn't go off anywhere until the military got involved. Then there was a lot of money. It's always money. Then a lot of money got injected into it. And from there, the first thing they started to observe was that scar tissue was being inhibited.
Okay.
That myostatin pathway was being inhibited. Very similar to high intensity training. So when they were comparing the levels of myostatin decline after an hour, 3 hours of training in healthy people, they were noticing the same things within the injured population that they were basically experimenting on.
Interesting.
For a bunch of these, you know, soldiers. So as that myostatin got deactivated, obviously they were seeing that they were having increases in mTOR. So mTOR stands for mammalian target of rapamycin complex 1. It's a mouthful, but just understand that whenever you see mTOR C1, it means protein synthesis.
Okay.
So as they saw those levels go up, they thought, we've got something here. And then they basically went a little bit deeper, started to do some MRI, some CT studies, some muscle biopsy. And lo and behold, small little quadricep muscles that were calf muscles that they had put in somebody's quad so they can basically save their bone. Because I don't know if you or your audience didn't know, but if you lose muscle because it got blown off or cut off or shut off, the bone underneath it will go necrotic and it'll die. So there's a very unique relationship between the muscle and bone interface. Where they need one another.
So that must be that must also be, I know that they say, and I'm just reaching here, but I'm guessing, I know they say exercise is important to avoid bone loss as you age, especially for women. So it, is that same principle basically, or what?
Yeah, it is. Bones are a very dynamic organ that, just like muscle, because mind you, that net protein balance, every single day, your body's always breaking down muscle. And as we get older, we don't grow muscle with hormones anymore. We grow muscle, well, let's say not specifically, but we generally grow muscle by training muscle, which stimulates mTOR C1, or the muscle protein synthesis pathway. And then by consuming essential amino acids. And a lot of times it's funny that you'll see people that will say, I need to eat more protein on the days that I train. And say, well, you've already actually stimulated muscle. So you actually don't need as much to obviously be a normal person. But if the goal is to obviously compete, then yes, a little bit of more protein can help. But the days you train effectively, you've already stimulated muscle protein synthesis via that mTOR pathway. On the days you don't train and you're not stimulating by a mechanical, you know, transduction, it's a fancy word that means I put a load in my hand and I resist it. And that resistance is basically a combination of information from my joints and my muscle that my brain understands and says, ah, you want me to contract more muscle. So I'll help you to contract more muscle. We also do it via some chemicals, and we'll kind of talk about that because that's how this BFR stuff actually works. So let's kind of get to just to the point. Military sees, hey, this is the way to go. They green light it. They start growing muscle. These soldiers are bouncing back fast. They're saving limbs. And then they start looking a few beds over, and they're saying, there's a lot of ACL injuries that are coming in. There's a lot of ankle sprains, some Achilles repairs. Why don't we try it on these guys? I mean, they're humans that also need to maintain muscle mass. Because as we lose muscle mass from being injured, we also lose strength. And as we lose muscle mass and strength, we obviously will start to have less function, more impairment. And then if you understand the biopsychosocial model of healthcare, which means there's a biological factor, a psychological factor such as fear, anxiety, fear avoidance, depression, those will then lead to the societal factors, which is fear avoidance. I start detracting and pulling away from activities, and then it just persists, right? Because now I'm not doing stuff I used to do, so I'm more depressed. If I'm more depressed, I'm affecting my biology even more because my immune system is intricately tied into my nervous system. So if I'm not feeling good, like feel, you know, the parts of your brain that you can have your emotional responses, it does have an actual effect on your body's biology. Yeah, I mean, think about like when you're sick, right? Right now with COVID-19 and this going around, there's a lot of people, especially people I talk to, because, you know, for your audience, you don't know, I'm a physical therapist. I've been in the world of rehab for 12 years. My background is also an exercise physiologist. So I'm an ex-phys first, a PT second. I love lifting weights. I'm a musician and an artist as well. But the calls that I've been taking recently, because my clinic has been closed, has been from a hotline of bunch of people from around the whole world. And the one thing you'll hear is, my body hurts. So how do we go from feeling good to feeling bad? Well, that virus that's affecting your immune system is also intricately tied into your nervous system. It's why your body feels weaker, because your body's trying to conserve energy, basically to help you to try to mobilize your immune system, build antibodies, and, you know, survive and heal beyond this. So, you know, the amazing thing about BFR, you know, is that I got involved somewhere around 2013, 2014, starting to read the literature, getting way more in depth with it. Then I linked up with Johnny around the end of 2014, 2015, and got to work for him as a clinical instructor. And that's really where I kind of took off and had a lot of opportunities to work with the military, special forces, and then professional sports, NFL, NBA, MLB, NHL, FIFA, professional tennis, and then it kind of expanded from there. And that's really kind of how I started to connect more and more with people. And Johnny is such a huge wealth of data.
Yeah.
I've just been that next rung down where it's like, you know, I'm a weightlifter. I'm a I guess you could consider it a nerd who also likes to lift weights. So I get the lingo. And because of that, I really started to think way beyond just, you know, working with patients. And, you know, the good thing is that there's been hundreds and hundreds of papers that have supported the use of BFR working with healthies, because obviously that's where the data needed to start. We needed to first test healthy people and see somebody who's asymptomatic, who doesn't have muscle atrophy. What happens when we do this to them? And then from there, if it's safe, let's start bringing it into the, you know, the more risky populations. That's kind of where I sit now. I've got kind of one foot on, you know, the performance side, where I work with athletes to improve things like, you know, cardiovascular capacity, which just basically means making your heart, which is the pump and the plumbing system, much healthier. So you can recover faster. Obviously, you can perform better. Your muscles have better endurance in general. And then as well, working in the area of strength, the area of hypertrophy, and that kind of is on two ends, because on the performance side, just kind of like your audience, that's really like, how best can I program this tool within a year's worth of training so that I'm effectively using it and I'm not kind of anecdotally approaching it thinking that I'm going to get super jacked or super strong with it, because the data would suggest otherwise if you're not programming it correctly. And then on the other hand, the rehab side, which is where we use it to basically help patients, you know, stop the atrophy post-surgery, post-injury, regrow bone after a fracture much better and sometimes much faster. Okay, and we'll kind of get to that later on if you want to. And then as well, focus on helping them to obviously not produce as much scar tissue and produce more viable collagen, which also happens when you – you basically stress your body out enough, which you can do with BFR quite well.
Okay. Well, let's focus then. I just want to jump in because I don't want to lose people. To start us out here then on what it actually is. Like, how does this apply with bodybuilding? I mean, I've seen people using it. I know that there's specific tools that we should use. That's something we should definitely cover today. I know that there's going to be specific methods to use. I've seen people do it wrong, and I think you probably have. We had talked in the past. I believe you have some stories, too, of people who – there have been basically nightmare situations of people who have made some big mistakes. So this isn't something you want to just, like, dive into today, right? Tell us a little bit more about how we would use this for sports, for muscle growth, really.
So, so in general, what blood flow restriction is the application of a tourniquet-like device that is put around either the upper arms, very up here, like right around, like above the bicep, On the upper parts of the leg, typically it's not put on all four. So it's either two upper or two lower. And then you're either applying a certain amount of pressure or you're using like what I use for research and also for treatment and training, which is we use cuffs that you put air in. So it's like a blood pressure cuff.
Oh, no kidding.
That allows you to more accurately measure how much pressure you're putting in so that you can standardize it. But it also helps you to be in a safe zone. So you're not putting too much pressure, which can, in a sense, cut off a lot of circulation to your arm. If you've got it maybe with too high pressure, you can damage nerves. So, you know, you want to do it right. But when done correctly, you reduce the amount of blood flow into your arm or leg. You cut off completely the amount of return of blood back to your heart from that arm or leg. So we call that venous return. When your arteries put blood in, your veins take blood out. So as you're exercising with these cuffs on, your arm is basically starting to get engorged and starts to have basically like congestion with all of this blood and byproducts that are trying to come out. And what that does is it stimulates these special nerves that tell your brain, we're working hard. I need you to contract harder.
No kidding.
And as you start to work, although the weight is very light, because typically when people are training with BFR, they're going to be training with anywhere from 20 to about 40% of their one repetition max. So it's not a lot of weight. But when the pressure is set up correctly, the repetition and set scheme is set up correctly in the frequency, you're going to see hypertrophy occur with similar results compared to heavyweight training, which via the American College of Sports Medicine, moderate to heavy is going to be anywhere from above 60% of a one rep max.
Okay.
Which means at 20% of a one rep max compared to 60, you're going to see equivocal hypertrophy. You're going to see equivocal tendon adaptations, which is awesome. When we're thinking about people that have had chronic just tendon problems for years, where they try to load heavy and they just keep hitting that wall and they go through kind of like that cyclical, what we call acute bout of inflammation on a chronic tendon. So that's really helpful for them. So as you're exercising and your arms are filling up with all this stuff, your brain is thinking it's got to contract harder. That process is basically something called Henneman size principle. I don't know if you've heard of that or if your audience knows it. All it means is, in simple terms, is it's a very linear process of intensity to muscle contraction. So as the intensity goes up, you have more and more muscle fibers assisting with contraction.
Okay.
So when intensities are very low, you're using your type 1 muscle fibers, which are your like your endurance ones. It's the ones we use for walking and for posture. But as the intensity increases, either because you're lifting heavier weight or your brain senses that the environment in your muscle is becoming much more acidic, which albeit happens when you start to lift heavy weight, because you start to recruit these type 2 muscle fibers that have a byproduct of hydrogen. And hydrogen is an acid and it burns you. And that's what you feel when you're lifting weights. A lot of times people think that's lactic acid that you feel, but the reality is it's the hydrogen you feel that's burning you. The lactic acid is actually a buffered form of that acid. It's when your body has an absorbent amount of extra sugar that it's not using to pump into these type 1 muscle fibers anymore. And so what it starts to do is cleave apart the sugar into two halves. And one of those halves is called pyruvate. So if I take that pyruvate and I bind it to hydrogen, I get a molecule called lactic acid.
Okay.
So lactic acid is actually what we call metabolically conditional carbohydrate, which means the more that you train in this environment, the better your body gets at using lactic acid as a fuel source for the muscle that's training. But as well, later it can be used by your liver, where your liver will take it, separate the hydrogen, get that pyruvate, combine it again with another pyruvate and make more glucose for the future. Or in cases of heart attack and stroke, it can actually supply those organs a primary fuel source. And that's actually a population that in the clinical world is having some research with BFR in there. And there are already now cardiac rehab studies that are using BFR to specifically help and train the heart and help and reduce stress to the heart as well. So again, you got tourniquets on, you're training. When performed correctly, you're going to see increases in hypertrophy and strength and most undoubtedly muscle endurance. Now this depends, you know, like, all right, that sounds cool. How do I apply that, you know, with what I'm doing? A lot of times when it comes to strength athletes, or power athletes, the real idea to apply it is basically to improve cardiovascular health. You know, when you're training with moderate to heavy loads, you are actually performing very similar activities to BFR already. As your muscles contract, they provide deep pressure to the deep arteries, which slows down the rate of oxygen. That slowing down of the rate of oxygen gets picked up by these special metaboreceptors. They're a specialized nerve that can sense a change in oxygen and pH. And they basically call up to the brain, hey, there's a lot going down here. We're starting to work. I need you to start inhibiting those slow twitch muscle fibers, those type ones. I need you to start activating the type two. That's that Henneman size principle, right? See. It's also the force velocity curve. I don't know if you know what that is. It basically just means that as you increase in muscle intensity, because the weight is heavy, you end up moving the weight much slower. So as the weight goes slower, muscle recruitment goes up. So things, if the X represented speed, from zero being no speed to 100 being fast speed, you'll see that muscle recruitment at very slow speeds is very, very high, like an isometric, can produce a ton of muscle contraction.
Interesting.
Versus if you're producing a lot of repetitions, you're going to typically produce very, very little muscle motor unit recruitment or muscle contraction, because your body doesn't feel like it has to. But if you throw in a BFR tourniquet, it forces you back the other direction, and you actually start to see more increased motor unit recruitment as the BFR makes you fatigue much faster. And that's basically what it does. It just makes your muscles tired way sooner than they're supposed to get with that light weight, which makes your brain think you're working much harder than you are, and therefore you have way more motor unit recruitment. And basically, with more motor unit recruitment, you're just stimulating more mTOR.
So
getting much more synthesis going on.
How would you perform your reps then? Because in general, you know, you got me thinking here, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I normally, you know, I have a nice slow controlled rep, and you're explaining to me why that could be beneficial, that I'm going to get more fiber recruitment. What would you do in this case?
Now you can't artificially do this, though. That's kind of one of the interesting things a lot of studies have shown, is that if you artificially attempt to move slow, you're not going to increase the intensity per se in the beginning.
Okay.
But as you continue to go, eventually you're going to build up enough fatigue. We call that peripheral fatigue, enough fatigue in the periphery, in the limb, that you're going to have an increase in motor unit recruitment. So for a lot of people, like, going slow is better than going fast. This is very dependent, because it depends on the level of intensity.
What you're telling me then is, so normally what I'm thinking is, and I'm not thinking of like the super slow reps, I'm just thinking of, you know, I try to control my reps, use the weight in the muscle versus using any kind of centrifugal force, that's different than when the weight gets so hard that the I couldn't move faster if I wanted to. That's what you're talking about.
The weight has to physically slow you down.
I see.
That's why we see that moderate to heavy loads typically can be more advantageous for stimulating muscle growth and having strength changes.
Okay.
Obviously, other benefits to cardiovascular, benefits to your bone. And the lighter weight that you go, the less of that you see.
If you take
the light weights to a high intensity, which means you take them to failure, you're going to see very similar levels of muscle recruitment, very similar levels of muscle hypertrophy. Not exact similar levels of strength, though, because strength is something that is more complex, because you have to – it's about motor control. It's your body figuring out how to manipulate a heavy weight, and there's multiple things happening with that. Grip, body position, if you're on a bench, if you're standing. So heavy weight requires you to train with heavy weight. Where BFR can fit in there – can be to benefit cardiovascular improvements, because a lot of times the problem with weightlifting is that if you're like, man, I want to get some cardio benefits, you're typically thinking, I'm going to lose all my gains because I've got to now be on a treadmill for a while. And that's not going to help me. And what we've learned with BFR is that, you know, those 35, 45 minutes at above 60% of your heart rate reserve to see benefit to VO2, which is your body's endurance, and benefit to your heart, can be trimmed down to actually only 10 to 15 minutes at about 40% of your heart rate reserve, which is nothing more than a walk at maybe at around above conversational level pace.
Okay.
And you'll see similar cardiovascular benefits plus better recovery because your body starts to learn to train in a more lactic acid rich environment, which again actually does improve over time. So you're kind of, your body's tolerance to that, your tolerance to pain gets much better when you train that way. And in fact, that plays a big role with what I do with a lot of my athletes. I'll typically program in anywhere from 4 to 5 10-minute sessions throughout the week.
Okay.
That's it. With them walking on, you know, maybe a treadmill at about 60% of the total pressure that would be needed to cut off all the flow in their legs.
Yeah.
So we call that 60% of their systolic blood pressure or limb occlusion pressure. And they'll walk for 10 minutes. Yeah, maybe on a small grade, you know, 2 to 4% grade. And then, you know, that's it. They'll typically do it 6 hours after they train in the gym, or they'll do it on an off day with some mobility for recovery. That tends to be very favorable. And then on the weightlifting side, if we're thinking, you know, I want to perform exercise with this, we typically do it before training.
Really? Okay.
So we'll do like one round of non-fatiguing exercise, maybe something like leg extension, for example, something super simple for the quads. It could be hamstring curls.
Okay.
It will be like 4 sets of 15. They're inflated the entire time. So meaning they put the cuff on.
Yeah.
They know how much pressure they need to apply. We've measured that. You can measure that via just taking your blood pressure from your arm. Okay. Once you take that blood pressure from your arm, if you were to want to train your arms, you would take 50% of that number, and that's what you would use to train the upper body.
Huh.
For the lower body, you would still take the pressure from the arm, and you can quasi add anywhere from like 30 to 40 millimeters of mercury above that. And that's probably going to be kind of the anywhere from maybe about like 60 to 70% for your lower leg. And that's a good training start point for the amount of pressure you need for your legs.
Okay.
And that's if you're not using, you know, something more sophisticated like a Doppler, you know, or, you know, we use those in clinic, but most people don't have those.
I imagine right now people may be getting a little bit lost. I know I am. So if I were doing this at home, how would I be able to measure that? Are you saying that there's I guess that's my question. If I were doing this at home, how do I measure that?
Yeah. So let's say, for example, the best way to apply BFR is going to be to use a device that you can put air in. I generally don't recommend using knee straps or any of the straps you might find online.
Yeah.
Reason being is because it's very arbitrary. You don't know how much pressure you're putting.
Yeah.
Typically the elastic device kind of gives way with it. So the problem with that is that you're going to perform a lot of repetitions.
Okay.
And performing too many reps is going to do the opposite of what we want.
Hmm.
Too many reps makes your brain tired, leads to central fatigue, and that drops motor unit recruitment. We want to find the sweet spot for that lightweight to create a lot of peripheral fatigue, get your muscles tired really quick, you know, within less than 3 minutes, you know, get in, get out, get the work done.
Okay.
So I don't generally recommend knee wraps. I'll recommend something like, so there's a company called H Plus. They also go by Physio Cuff. There's one called Fit Cuff. And there's another one that's called Smart Tools Cuff. So generally, each of these are basically the same. It's a blood pressure cuff. They're a little wider. They're designed to be washed and rinsed. So you can use them, throw them in your gym bag. You put them on your arm. How you would get the pressures, you can just go to Walgreens, Walmart. Obviously now times are a little bit different to going out, but
sure.
Basically just use a standard blood pressure cuff device. Check your systolic blood pressure on your upper body.
Mm.
That number, as you check it, that systolic blood pressure, that's going to be, if I filled up a tourniquet to that much on your arm, at that amount, you're not going to have macro circulation into the arm. So we would say that you're at 100%.
Okay.
So that 100%, we're going to go down to 50%. That 50% number, that's what you're going to train up for the arm.
Okay.
Okay.
This makes more sense now, because initially all I had known was the devices, the bands that I would see, you know, on Amazon or whatever, where they say these are blood flow restriction bands. And it basically is just either a rubber band or some type of a cloth band with elastic. So this is, you're actually using a cuff. What, and it, I'll, I'll, I'll put some links. I'll get some links from you, put those in the show description in case anybody did want to check them out then. I'm back with you now.
Yeah. And in fact, and some of these cuff companies actually just reached out to them recently, and I'm getting it set up so that we can use the code REBUILD2020. That'll give you, obviously, I think it's like 20% off of the cuffs, or if not, maybe 10, somewhere between there.
Okay.
The proceeds, basically that 10% off is going to go back to a charity basically for COVID-19. So I'm looking for charities right now that can help in, you know, sponsor, just providing medical supplies, to certain hospitals and, or supplying, just food, you know, for people who might need it. So I'm not going to take anything from that. But when I get all that set up, you know, I'll give it to you so you can put in the show notes.
Excellent, guys. That'll be cool. Anybody who's interested, you know, you guys go to the show notes, or you can contact me.
Yeah, make some gains for yourself and help some other people too. You know, it's a giving process. So now that we're on task.
Yes.
All right. It's on the arm. I'm 50% of that systolic blood pressure. I'm ready to go train. Typically, the training that would be done, if we're going just by the literature, is 4 sets. That's the typical scheme.
Okay.
So I inflate and I deflate only at the end of those 4 sets. Okay.
Okay.
Now, those 4 sets, the first one is called a primer set. That one is typically done at about 30 repetitions. Then there's a 30-second rest period. And then starts the next 3 actual working sets.
Okay.
By the literature, those 3 working sets are 15 reps, 15 reps, and 15 reps. So it's a block of 15.
Huh.
In between each one is a 30-second break. So in the end, it's going to take you roughly on average about anywhere from 6 minutes, you know, 5.5, 6 minutes to complete this whole rep scheme.
Yeah.
If you're trained at a 1 concentric, 1 eccentric tempo, so 1 second up, 1 second down, or a 2 second concentric, 2 second eccentric tempo, so 2 second up, 2 second down. Those are typically the tempos we want to use, because any slower than that, we just don't get that right sweet spot for fatigue in the muscle. We don't get the right intensity.
Yeah.
We don't see the right levels of contraction. So you do want to hit that sweet spot, and it sucks if it's your first time doing it. It's not going to be a fun experience. So I generally recommend people to start with pretty lightweight. Probably even less than 20% of a 1 rep max.
Okay.
Just to kind of get a feel for it, so that you don't get kind of freaked out by like, wow, what the hell just happened? Because this is going to create a pump like you've never had before. When you do it right, when the pressure is right. I mean, even a pump, like even to like the small lumbricals that are in your hand, you know, you're doing correct weight and you've got like sufficient grip on that.
Yeah.
I was about to use the word gnarly. It's pretty gnarly.
I can imagine, man. I got to be full disclosure here. Years ago, I had tried this with my quads, using just like my wraps. I never had good success because I couldn't get them to wrap at a tension that I felt comfortable with. I could never get them to stay the way I wanted them to. But I know that now, I think what I had done was maybe like 3 consecutive sets or something. And I know that by like after set 1, it starts getting uncomfortable. And and I could imagine if you have the pressure wrong, that it could become really unbearable. I would want to make sure, I guess, I like the idea of going into this with the right knowledge and doing it properly. Because honestly, I think that's why I gave up. And I think that that's the reason that the majority of people who have given it a try haven't been happy with it in the past. You know, just average guys in the gym who are messing around with this because they haven't had, I think, the right equipment. It sounds like that's got to be quite a key if you're going to get this right. But it sounds like there's a lot of reasons. I mean, so we have the possibility of muscle growth here first. And before we get off that, because I want to talk about possibility of like tendon recovery, things like that, because that sounds amazing. And I think a lot of us could benefit from it. How fast have you seen people make results with this as far as muscle growth goes?
So generally, muscle growth takes roughly about anywhere from 4 to 5 weeks. And that's typically with a frequency of about 3 to sometimes 4 times a week, anywhere from 2 to 3 exercises per muscle group done at each session.
Okay.
So like if I gave you like an example of like a week 1 approach that I generally give to most people, Usually week one, I'm telling them, I'm going to want you to at least set aside 3 days where we're going to do some cardiovascular work.
Yeah.
Because cardiovascular work, you're going to have a lot less soreness when you do it. Mm. You'll recover much faster from it. So that may be, you know, 3 5-minute sessions in the week. And again, I would have them, you know, with a cuff on the legs at about 60% of their limb occlusion pressure, or I would have them measure their systolic blood pressure from their arm, and then I would have them add, you know, 30 more on top of that. Okay. And that's basically going to be kind of where their leg needs to be trained. Hmm. And you don't want to develop what I call the PPs, which is pain and paresthesia. Hmm. Paresthesia is a fancy word for numbness. So you don't want to get pain and numbness. That means the pressure is too high.
Yeah.
So that's why we assess the legs a little bit differently. We use a Doppler. And we'll measure off your artery that's on the inner part of your leg, just behind a bone of your ankle.
Okay.
So there's a good artery back that we can measure. So I'll have them start that way, and then I'll have them start with 2 days a week of basically a total body circuit. And that's probably going to be 2 quad exercises, 2 hamstring exercises, 2 calf exercises. Hmm. Make it real simple. Because mind you, each one of those is going to take 5 minutes. Hmm. So right off the bat, you know, that's already a good time spent working out the lower legs, and you'll feel it. I mean, you're going to be like, my leg's got a pretty significant workout. And then I'll usually throw in maybe the upper body as well, with either like, you know, 1 for the bicep, 1 for the tricep, and then I'll go compound. And there's when you're kind of organizing these exercises with BFR, you have to understand that all it does is just create fatigue much sooner. Mm. So there's still a lot of things from training that you still have to apply. Hmm. Like for example, isolation exercises typically will lead to more muscle recruitment because there's less things that your brain is having to manage. So like a bicep curl, for example, is going to have more potential long hit of biceps recruitment, especially if you're doing something like an incline seated bicep curl, right, where your bicep, your arm is basically behind you and you're curling, so it's more of a stretch at the long hit of the bicep.
Yeah.
Versus potentially doing something like a shoulder press, which still uses the long hit of your bicep, but it's a compound movement, but that also comprises your delt and your tricep and your pec.
Yeah.
And the same is kind of true for your legs. If you did a straight leg raise, you lay on the ground flat in your back and you tighten up your quad and you lift that leg straight up, that's a very, very rigorous exercise for your rectus femoris, which is a muscle that basically flexes your hip and extends your knee. And it does both of those together with, you know, with this one exercise. You're getting more recruitment with that than you actually will if you were performing a squat.
Yeah.
Now given that's at relative intensities, obviously you can squat more than you can straight leg raise, and you can shoulder press more than you can bicep curl. So these things, you know, there's a reality to why that is. Okay. So when you're performing BFR, generally I usually pick exercises that are isolation first, and then they go to compound. So like that leg exercise may be, you know, knee extension, then maybe a straight leg raise, a hamstring curl, probably a standard calf raise. And then I would go to something like a squat, or I would go to something like a bridge. So I would keep the compound exercises for the end of that session and keep, you know, the isolation ones for the beginning. So I actually would reverse it.
Yeah.
And that's because the isolation exercises are going to produce a ton of muscle contraction, but to very specific areas. And I think that's where it's really key if you're dealing with chronic tendon problems, that this is where it actually can fit in there, where the exercises that you're performing are ones that are very isolated exercises for those areas of chronicity or those areas of chronic pain. So like people who can lift heavy, I tell them, continue to lift heavy. Don't think BFR is going to supplement your heavy lifting, because if you don't have to be load managed or because you're not load compromised, then train heavy because that's going to be the best for all of the tissue types in your body. But if you're dealing with a nagging problem, hey, let's take 2 days out of the week. Let's focus on that nagging problem with BFR, doing some very isolated exercises that can really help to produce the right amount of stimulus for the muscle, but more importantly for the tendon to actually start getting some good basically collagen uptake, because your tendons need mechanical stress in order to heal. And that's kind of one of the the issues with most people that have chronic tendon problems is that as they try to load, the pain will typically stop them from wanting to load anymore. And it's important to understand that this is one of those careful concepts where you actually do need to load more to see the tendons get better.
No kidding.
But the problem can lay in there in that if that individual has been in that situation for too long, they've likely also developed chronic pain.
Yeah.
And the problem with chronic pain is that it also affects how well your muscles can contract. So we want to address the pain to help you to contract better. Surprisingly, in the world of clinical BFR, because the weight is so light, you're not getting any of the potential damage that would happen with a heavier load.
Yeah, okay.
But you get the benefit of the high levels of recruitment and also the high levels of collagen synthesis that happen because of another pathway that happens when you train muscles hard and make growth hormone. Growth hormone makes IGF-1, it makes collagen. Some cool stuff that happens. It's what your body does normally to recover. Okay, this way we just get to use it with lighter weights. But the benefit of doing that is that now you can actually continue to train and see some real benefit. So those hypertrophy ones, you had asked me this originally, about 4 weeks, tendon, typically around 6 weeks of using it. So again, typically I start people off with a mix of cardio and some weightlifting, and each week that goes by, we're progressing, adding, you know, more time to the cardio, because again, that cardiovascular support system, again, for weightlifters and especially powerlifters, all right, powerlifters are notorious for having cardiovascular just disease, cardiovascular problems that increase their risk for stroke, increase their risk for obviously diabetes and other circulatory complications. So we want to work that cardiovascular system. It's how your body delivers nutrition. It's how it gets rid of waste. So that's how we typically do it. Every week, we're adding a little bit more time on the cardio. We're adding a little bit more stress on the exercise, meaning that 30, 15, 15, 15 might start to look a little bit more like, you know, maybe 30, 15, 15 failure, 30, 15 failure, failure, then eventually failure, 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 all the sets taken a failure.
Okay.
But we're doing it for a very specific amount of time. And if you can train heavy, we mix it in with what you're doing for training heavy so that it's not impeding your recovery. In fact, it's helping your recovery, because too much BFR too soon, hey man, like anything, too much of anything is going to break the system. And our bodies are incredible. Our DNA is just so fascinating how when you stress it, it immediately tries to adapt and recover to that stress.
Yeah.
You know, I hear this often on like the Joe Rogan podcast, like our ancestors, right? We're the genesis of these ancestors that weren't the ones trying to figure out math, you know, trying to figure out complex science. We're the ones that tried to basically need to survive, you know? Yeah. So we still have that instinctual aspect of our brain, which is like, oh, something moved. Where is it? I got to go kill it.
Right.
You know, given there's been enough generations, I think now with people thinking about science that you end up with nerds like me, that are still, you know, still strong, but at the same time, nerdy enough to think about these complex things.
You walk the line.
Yeah, I try to. Yeah. Generally speaking, for somebody who's starting BFR, it's less is more. Start with, again, I usually give that kind of structured program, you know, 3 days of cardio, 2 days of weightlifting. We follow those exact rep schemes I gave you. And then as we progress, we're just changing things up. Just a little bit. It's very useful for athletes that are from off season going back to in season. Can provide a ton of benefit for cardiovascular capacity, which basically means your time to fatigue gets better. Your top speed can actually get better. So there's studies that have looked at special forces, collegiate athletes, professional athletes, semi-professional athletes, all healthies, all got better. And doing simple stuff. Five to 10 minutes, 40% of their heart rate reserve, about 60%, you know, of their systolic blood pressure on their legs, anywhere from 4 to 5 days a week.
Okay.
You know, those are the ones that they're using in the research. And then as far as, again, the strength and hypertrophy side, it can be as simple as, you know, a minimum of 2 days a week, maximum of 4 days a week. using that repetition scheme and then progressing from 20% of a one rep max up to 40% of a one rep max.
Okay.
And you can't test these things out, you know, on some muscle groups that you can't test out, you know, your true 100%, you know, on a box of curl and it be specific to that, because little factors can change that. So I generally just tell people, start with a lightweight, see if you can actually just complete the whole protocol.
Okay.
And complete that protocol, start going up by 2 to 5 pounds. And that may sound like a little bit, but it's going to be a wake up call on how little weight it takes when the pressure is right to create that sweet spot of intensity where you see all those beneficial changes happen.
No kidding. So, and like you said, coming from an off season back into a season, as you mentioned before we got started too, could be super beneficial. I can see two things right now. A, nobody's at the gym because the gyms are all closed. So this could be a good way to get back in. Or B, it doesn't sound like you need much weight to do this. So if you were to have the cuffs, this is something that would be, this would be a great time to experiment with it at home.
Yeah, I mean, just using something like a standard, resistance exercise band, a stool, your body weight, try to do, most people can't even do 70 something pushups. So pushups with this, you're going to probably be doing them off the wall or probably off your couch.
Yeah.
That's going to be more than enough. And, this is a good time to think about that. I think about it often as a physical therapist that, you know, right now we have a lot of people staying at home that aren't going to the gym. They're deconditioning. So we said this earlier, kind of like your level of toughness is going down because you're not stimulating that. So you're losing some of your body's kind of metabolic, defense. Mm. And that means that you're at a higher susceptibility to injury when you go back to the gym. So for all the listeners, don't just go back to the gym when life somewhat starts to get back to normal and think you're going to hit it the way you were hitting it before.
Yeah.
There's a higher risk you're going to get hurt. So I look at BFR as a tool that might help us to rebuild or recondition a lot of people that need to go back. We mentioned that off season to on season. I also use it in season when athletes are more load managed, because any excess of load might put them in a load compromise situation where they're going to overreach, overtrain, and then get hurt.
Yeah.
So use it in that scenario to kind of maintain, you know, their cardiovascular output. So I don't have to have them, you know, pounding on a treadmill for running. I can just have them walking or riding a bike. There's also use for it in the water. If there's any interest with that, there actually are some water studies.
No kidding.
That I've looked at, like professional swimmers, non-professional swimmers, and then actually women, that have osteopenia, that are using it in the water in conjunction with aquatics to improve bone density, muscle mass and strength. So we've got that before season, we've got that in season, and then obviously strategically placed within an actual periodization, where we're kind of using it for cardiovascular capacity throughout the whole year, never really going beyond 20 minutes. So that's kind of the goal, is you kind of stop at 20, like work up to 20, then you don't need any more than that. It's actually really good for also maintaining overall body composition. Mm. There is a study that does show you might burn a few more calories with BFR. I wouldn't be hanging my hat on that just yet. Okay. I would rather say, look, you need some cardiovascular, work. Walking on a treadmill is actually a really good way to do a lot of benefit for your body. And if you're doing it with BFR, it shows to have additional benefit, especially for the elderly who cannot be lifting heavy weight, or even somebody who's maybe got, you know, some chronic arthritis in their knee or in their hip from years of lifting heavy. Mm. You know, a lot of strongmen, a lot of power lifters. It was not intentional. I happened to pick it right out of the laundry, but now that I'm looking at my own image in the camera,
yeah.
Kabuki Strength. So Chris Duffin, good friend of mine. He has, we've been using BFR, in his, rehab and as well as in his training strategically, to help him to get to what you probably just saw him do recently, which was 1,000, you know, for three.
Like three reps. Yeah. That was insane, man. That was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, we've done a lot of planning over the phone. He's got some cuffs that I gave to him to use.
Okay.
I work with his team and get them set up with it. And he's like a good example of somebody who has really run their body through, through the course of just of reps, life stress. I mean, if you've gotten to read his story, it's an incredible one. his book kind of companioned me all through Europe when I took a recent trip there.
That's cool.
And it was a really eye opening, you know, book. I messaged him multiple times and I was just like, Chris, bro, you got me in tears right now, man. In tears, dude. But nonetheless, though, when strategically, you know, put into somebody's programming, it can make a lot of benefit. But at the end of it, then we got to think, you know, guys that can't be lifting heavy, you know, there are other avenues for you to take. Mm. And this is one of the best ones that we have found, because it's going to help and improve, obviously, just your overall health. Again, your muscle is an organ. Okay. If you train your muscle regularly and you work it to a high intensity, even without BFR, you're going to improve things like insulin sensitivity. You're going to improve also just the metabolic function of your muscle, some pre-hormones that it helps to make. And all those things directly help your heart, directly help your brain in reducing risk of heart attack and stroke. But with BFR, we see that you're able to also get some additional benefits to tendon health and bone health that you don't generally get with lightweight, even when taken all the way to failure. At least we can say that for the current time, the literature doesn't show that. The literature shows that lightweight can, if taken to failure, can be equivocal to heavyweight for hypertrophy, but it is not equivocal for bone and tendon and cardiovascular, unless you're doing it with BFR. That seems to be the tool that kind of bridges the gap between the lightweight and the heavyweight, for making real change, in our basically our masterclass lifters. You know, I'm 36. I recently had a dislocation to my right knee.
Yeah.
It was Christmas Day. Kids are jumping all around me. It jumped on the floor. I was sitting in a weird position, and my tibiofemoral joint actually
– oh, God.
Dislocated. It was locked in place. I grabbed my knee, kind of pushed it back in. For the next month or so, really had just an increased amount of, you know, knee swelling. I'm my worst patient, so I didn't go and get checked. I was already like, all right, this is what I'm going to do.
Of course you did.
I'm going to up my protein. I'm going to start my BFR. And because one of the benefits that happens with BFR is a change in your perception of basically threat or intensity. So you've probably heard of the repeated bout effect, right? The RBE. So your RBE, for audience who may doesn't know what this means, is again, your nervous system. Everything is your nervous system. So you got to understand this. When you start placing stress onto your nervous system, it is recording that information. So your brain is always on record, no matter what. Some things are more important that get stored to longer memory, but your brain is always on record. And it's always recording movement information too. That's how with continued repetition, right? Repetition, it's cumulative. It adds up. You get better at moving.
Yeah.
So when you stress your body out metabolically and you start to feel that acid burning in your muscle, that feel is because nerves that pick up that acidity are first going to your heart and telling your heart, yo, it's time to pick up the pace because we got to start getting stuff out of here. And then it goes to your brain and it starts to, you know, it goes to this one aspect, the center of your brain called the thalamus. That's like your threat detector.
Mm-hmm.
It's where all of us experience threat. So you consider like you bump your leg and those nerves fire up to your brain and your brain goes, that thalamus tells your brain, hey, something just hit our leg. We need to move. And your brain goes, okay, we're going to move. Let's start moving.
Yeah.
And then it starts to think, wait, have we been here before? Is this something we're familiar with? Let's check the memory center. Should we panic? Should we freak out? Should we have more pain than what we just experienced to kind of get away from it?
Right.
That's actually how pain can become chronic. But weight training does something interesting. Weight training uses that same pathway, but because you continue to repeat the process, your brain actually learns to not be threatened by that weight. And that's why the first adaptations we see in people who start weightlifting are not adaptations in their periphery, in their muscle tissue or in their bone. The first change we see happens in their brain, or we call it neuromuscular strength. So we say that that person can now perform a contraction that's faster and that's better and that's stronger.
Yeah.
Why? Because their brain has already gone through it once. So the repeated bout effect is that now I know it. I'm not afraid to do it anymore.
Sure.
And I'm more comfortable doing it. So with BFR, because the intensity is so high, the repeat bout effect is quite interesting in that if you perform it before lifting, generally speaking, you're going to see that individual not done to fatigue. So not done to a point of fatigue. So this is what I do. I typically take four sets of about 10 to 15 reps.
Yeah, yeah.
With anywhere maybe from like you know, 20 to 30 seconds between. So we'll do that, get that done. Then we'll start warming up. So simple mobility drills, kind of give them some time to get blood flow back into the limb.
Mm-hmm.
A few things happen. One, their perception of intensity is now shifted.
Yeah.
What they was maybe like, let's say if I use a 0 to 10 scale of intensity, where 10's the hardest thing I've ever done, if they feel a weight is like a 6 or 7, they're probably going to report it around maybe like a 4 or 5 or a 5 to 6, because now that threat detector is like, whoa, we just got a whole bunch of information. Hmm. We seem to be okay with it.
Yeah.
The part that is you, right? Your executive function is like, yo, I did this intentionally.
Right, right.
That part of your autonomic nervous system is like, all right, I'll listen to you.
So that,
I guess, okay.
This is something you could feel. This is something you could experience immediately, which I think is really cool. You know, something you would experience like that first workout.
Yeah, a good example. There's a lot of times where I've taken an athlete where they've already gotten pretty conditioned to the BFR. And I'll tell, you know, they're in a standard strength block. So they're still lifting, you know, between their 75 to 85% of their one rep max, with exposures into their 95, okay. You know, done strategically so that we're actually recovering. You know, most people don't realize when you're lifting in your 3 or your 1 rep max range, you are micro fracturing bone, and bone takes up to about, you know, 6 to 8 weeks to heal when it's a bad fracture. So, you know, you want to gauge this microfracture as best as you can, but that's another topic. Point is, I'll typically have them do their warm up with BFR.
Yeah.
Then we'll do some mobility drills. We'll get in the bar. We'll start racking the weight up. And then I'll tell them, hey, listen, I'm not going to tell you what's on the bar. I just want you to lift it. Okay. I know what you can do. I know you're safe to do it. So this is kind of where that relationship is super important. So there's trust.
Yeah.
And they'll go and they'll lift it and they'll be like, wow, that felt really good. Like, well, you just PR'd. Like, how is that? Like, what? I'm like, yeah, it probably feels a whole lot less heavy,
huh,
because it's a whole lot less threatening to your nervous system, because I just gave you something that was much more threatening.
Yeah.
But that kind of fatigue that you had did not have any lingering effects.
It makes total sense. It makes total sense.
Yeah. And that kind of fatigue is what we call, again, peripheral fatigue. So peripheral fatigue typically is a fatigue that happens in your muscles as a result of increasing in the byproduct that's produced by the muscle.
Okay.
Stimulates your brain to increase motor unit recruitment.
Huh.
It typically has anywhere from, you know, some minutes to all the way to maybe a whole day that you need to recover when you do a lot of it. Central fatigue is a fatigue that happens in your brain when you either have real muscle damage, so your brain knows, oh shit, something just tore. I don't have that same connection anymore. Or when you perform too many reps.
Mm.
Doing cardio before you weightlift.
Sure.
So that's way too many repetitions, and that constant repetitive movement, your brain actually gets tired, because again, we're not, our electrical system in our body is not like plugging into the wall.
Yeah.
This is all based on chemicals. So your brain does use up chemicals, and your muscles as well, but more so your brain. And your brain does not have a relatively easy way to clean itself like your muscle does. So your brain kind of like a dishwasher, you know, starts to rack up with dirty dishes all day until you at some point stop,
yeah,
go home and go to sleep. And when you sleep, your brain has the ability to then actually recover. Good night's rest in a good position can allow for the blood-brain barrier to kind of relax in some of its pressure, that allows for the lymphatic system, which is your immune system, to get cleaned out and kind of basically wash the dishes.
Right.
You wake up the next day and you're, dang, I feel good. You know, that's a result of your brain now having, you know, an opportunity to essentially help clean itself. But central fatigue can take up to 72 hours to get better. Mm. And that's actually what defines DOMS. Delayed onset muscle soreness, okay, is not just something that we experience in the periphery. It's something we experience in the central nervous system, and that's why it takes so many days to get better. Your muscle recovers.
Dude, you're blowing my mind here, because we've run long already, and I don't want to stop you, because now I'm like, well, shit, but I want to hear this. I want to hear. But finish us up with this thought, though. Please go on, because this is like everything you've got here, man. I'm like, wait, this all makes sense. And I could, even if it's something I didn't know, I could apply it to myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it generally should. So, and this is kind of one of the reasons why with BFR, a lot of times we see people make such fast advances once they get conditioned to it, is because the weight is low, so there's not a lot of muscle damage that happens.
Yeah.
Your brain is constantly exposed to high amounts of metabolic stress, so you actually start to have a better improved tolerance to this same stress, which is why we see things like sprint speed, or let's say time of sprinting improve.
Yeah.
But the same reason why we see people be able to lift heavier loads, because their brain is already being more, you know, tolerant to also higher levels of muscle contraction, which is great when you haven't been lifting for a while, but equally great if you've been avoiding lifting certain muscles for a while because they hurt.
Yeah.
Or in the event of a healthy athlete, maybe bring up a weak area too. You know, maybe there's just a, if you're like, man, just my left bicep doesn't contract like my right bicep. Years of trying to do that. Or, you know, my left hammy, I just don't feel it when I do that. Start throwing in some, you know, isolated exercises with BFR. Again, the right pressure, get the right protocol in there. You hit that sweet spot, you're going to be having a good amount of muscle recruitment. And now you should understand a little bit more as to why that's happening and why those effects tend to last for a good while. And how a lot of people can actually benefit from that. It's not just your healthy person, but I mean, a lot of people considering health risks. Okay, so there are risks, obviously, with everything. The biggest risks with BFR is hypertension, or basically high blood pressure. So if you are hypertensive, like stage one, it's important to make sure that we're addressing that as best as we can. Because when you put these tourniquets on and you don't have blood returning back to your heart, your heart rate is going to go up, and it's what we call a rate product. What that means is heart rate times stroke volume, and stroke volume is the amount of blood that comes back to your heart. It's part of it, equals cardiac output. So if I drop your stroke volume because I got a tourniquet on you, in order to maintain cardiac output so you don't pass out, your heart rate's got to go up. Now, this can be super beneficial for somebody who has just had, you know, a heart attack or open heart surgery, to actually start recovering their heart muscle, getting it stronger without as much blood coming into their heart and stretching it out and stressing it.
Yeah.
But it could also be beneficial for somebody who obviously needs to improve cardiovascular health, but they can't run, or maybe they can't stress themselves out that high, or in case of a weightlifter, doesn't want to, you know, maybe lose their gains. Another risk is obesity. So as you kind of get into your obese or morbid obese, and I'm not talking about BMI, okay, because BMI is sometimes not a good indicator for this, because you can have a very, very lean body mass individual, a lot of muscle, good bone density, but because of their height, a good example of John Meadows, a good friend of mine, the little Hulk. You kick my ass if I call them little, but the Hulk, let's call him. You know, his BMI would show that he's obese.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a big dude. Like, I'm not a huge guy myself, and I'm considered morbidly obese by the BMI. So, yeah. But you're talking about somebody who's, legit holding a lot of body fat.
Yes, and that's problematic, because as you try to put a tourniquet on that, it's very difficult to get enough pressure down to the deep artery, because you have to go through a lot of adipose tissue. And as you go through, you'll damage the adipose tissue. You'll create bruising. You'll create, there's very little risk, surprisingly, for clot formation when you're performing BFR. And the reason being is because when you put stress to an artery, and this happens every time you work out. So every time you work out and you're putting a lot of pressure on your arteries and you're shunting blood away from your heart, you would think, oh, man, This should be enough to create a clot, right?
Yeah.
Well, sophisticatedly enough, your arteries, when they feel that pressure increase, they release a chemical called TPA. And that TPA basically is a clot-busting enzyme.
No kidding.
So it ensures that you don't form a clot at all. Well, it's the reason why people don't stroke out when they're doing, you know, a one rep max deadlift and their face is getting all red and their veins are popping out and they're bleeding out of their eyes and their ears. Why they didn't clot out is because their arteries are releasing an endogenous TPA. Now, the word endogenous means from within.
Yeah.
TPA is a very important pharmaceutical drug that can be manufactured and given to somebody who's having a stroke. In fact, that's the people who are having a clot based, what's known as an ischemic stroke, you go to the hospital, they're like, all right, let's check, CT scan, all right, no hemorrhaging in the brain. This isn't a stroke that happened from a bursting of a blood vessel in the brain. This came from a clot somewhere else. A lot of times it comes from a clot from your heart. So what they'll do is they'll inject you with TPA, and it's the same enzyme you make when you exercise.
Interesting.
Guys, that's why when you exercise, it reduces your risk of stroke.
God damn. This is another thing. This, like I said, we're supposed to be wrapping up, and I'm still learning stuff here.
There are risks, obviously, with it.
Yeah.
But there's surprisingly not a lot of risks associated with clot. Now, that's given if you've been, obviously, clot-free for a while. So, you know, I have some patients that just had surgery, and they're high suspect for a clot. We won't put BFR in them. But interestingly enough, they'll still be prescribed TED hoses, so compression socks, that kind of the same thing. They stress the arteries as you move a little bit more, so you make more TPA. That's what compression socks can do. So when you hear people say, like, man, I feel so much better when I wear these compression socks, some of that is a lot of just their brain going, ooh, information, awesome, through the skin, compression, got it, I know where I'm at better. Another one is that they're actually improving some dilation.
Wow.
So they are getting a little bit more blood flow, but you know, I wouldn't say enough to maybe win a race, but it may be enough to just make you feel like you just want to go out in the cold and run maybe more often.
Interesting.
So that's okay. But there are some individuals that we kind of hold off and we don't do it with because of risk after a major surgery. You know, but typically I start my patients, you know, as soon as they're clear and they're ready to go and we're ready to start loading, we'll start there. And again, like you heard me say earlier on, a lot of times we're using it to reduce scar tissue, make sure that we're not having a lot of atrophy, you know, help bones heal faster. Some of my first patients I worked with were NFL athletes that just had stress fractures that wouldn't heal after like 12, 16 weeks.
Okay.
I had them for about 4 weeks and had union. And that was with them for 16 weeks taking calcium, vitamin D, bone-specific drugs, bone stimulators, nothing working. 4 weeks of BFR, land-based training, maybe mixed aqua, but it was really the BFR that did it. We had improvements in basically just bone growth and union of the fracture itself, or union onto a metal plate, which that was a few cases.
Huh. Well, listen, we got to wrap up, brother. We've gone pretty long, but I couldn't stop you because, like I said, man, I'm learning as I go here. If people wanted to reach out to you, though, or they wanted to follow what you're doing and they wanted to learn more, what's the best way for people to see what you're doing?
So right now I'll be getting back into Instagram in a little while. I've taken a long hiatus since October.
Right on.
My handle is at Lifters Clinic. My website will also be up soon. I had to make some changes to it. But that's where you'll basically find more information about me. If you are interested in actually just getting some good, some either good programming or direction to go with BFR, at this point, you can just straight up email me. So at mario@liftersclinic.com is my email. I typically field those pretty quickly. When people want to do training, we'll usually do a non-therapy training. So just because I'm a physical therapist, don't think I will be your physical therapist. you know, if you need PT, I'll usually find a PT in your zip code that is already certified, because I've certified hundreds of people through various companies through the various years that I've done this. I've built the education for Smart Tools, built the education for the BFR Pros, which are two other Con Ed companies. And then I worked for Owens Recovery Science, which is a great, great source for just BFR clinical information. But I definitely would say for the training side of things, eventually my site will be up and you'll be able to get a lot of the training stuff just from there. But so for now, you can just email me. I'll get you set up with what you need and get you rocking. And like I said, I'm working with a lot of these cuff companies right now to just set up a charity where, you know, you spend some money for you, you know, experiment with it, get the gains, and help out some people that are really going to need it right now, because we got a long road ahead of us. And I really think that we're going to have to really recondition and rebuild, you know, America back to the former health that we were at. So.
Right on. Well, I'll get I'll get some links from you then to put up in the show notes. And if you don't get the charity set up by the time that we release the show, when you do have that set up, I'll update the show notes. So that will be in there, you know, for the foreseeable future, you know, on YouTube and everything else, man. Mario, I got to tell you, man, I really appreciate this. I came into this, you know, like I said, my experience with BFR was just trying to do it myself from what somebody else told me, using lit knee wraps in my gym, you know, a decade ago. I expected to learn a little bit more about how it's really done, which I did, but I learned so much more. And I can tell, man, this is still just the tip of the iceberg. You could keep going. I know you, I had to jump in because I know that you could keep going. So I really appreciate your time, man. And I really appreciate you sharing your education. I can tell just how passionate you are about this.
Yeah, well, equally, man, I appreciate what you're doing out there, helping to connect the educators with, you know, an audience that's, you know, that's hungry, that's interested to learn more. It's a great opportunity and a privilege to be able to do that. So I really appreciate, you know, you having me on. And, yeah, I look forward to doing one of these other brain dips some point down the road. So, yeah, man, it's been awesome. Appreciate it.
All right, guys, for another episode of Think Big Bodybuilding Media and Advices Radio, I'm Scott McNally with Dr. Mario Nova. Thanks, Mario.
You're welcome, man.